I'm here in Brussels, in Belgium, with the special guest of my show. Can you introduce yourself a bit?
My name is Ricardo Cygnus, and I'm the Pumpkin, the release manager for Pearl 5.
Okay. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks.
Yeah. So is this the first time to be in Brussels, Belgium?
Yeah. This is my first time at Vosdem and my first time in Brussels.
How do you find it?
I like it. I always find it really interesting when I come to Europe that all the cities have a unique character, and I can come to one city and really feel like it's different than the last place I left. It's always enjoyable.
Mm-hmm. And we are here for this conference called Vosdem. It's free software, open source software developer European meeting.
Yes.
it's pretty much like Open Bridge, Open Source Developers Conference, but it's pretty European style, I would say. There's no registration required. You can buy beer at the cafeteria, and you can even drink it inside the room for the talks.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting.
It's very unusual. It is very much unlike a lot of other conferences I've gone to, and not just because of that, but yeah, it's very much, it's like they've had a flash mob of hackers show up and like, yeah, we'll all bring beer and we'll talk about software. It's great. I like it.
Yeah. So yeah, it's the first time for me as well. And it's the second day right now. And yesterday you gave a talk about Pearl 5, the next release of Pearl 5.
Yeah. So the next release is coming out in May. And it's, I guess I think the fourth release that I've done the release of. It looks good. I'm pretty excited about it. And I always enjoy getting to give a talk every year of what's new and tell people the stuff I think is really, really exciting. It's exciting for me. And then other people get excited about the features, and it makes me feel even more excited about it. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Can you briefly explain what the structure of Pearl 5, the development of the language is, and when you took over this maintenance stuff?
So I'll start with a really brief history, which is, after Pearl 5.8, which was like the Pearl for a long time, it took years for Pearl 5.10 to come out. And after it came out, it was taking a long time for the next bug fix release to come out. And there was a lot of unhappiness about how long these releases took, and there wasn't any criteria for doneness. And Jesse Vincent sort of spearheaded an attempt to get this to fix this problem. And the fix was, every month we would have a new development release, and every year we would have a stable release. And a lot of this was copied from Parrot, which is a project related to Pearl 6. They would do these monthly releases, and it helped in a lot of ways. And I got on early doing these monthly releases. And from there, when Jesse retired, I got suckered into doing the annual releases. So every year we release a new stable Pearl, and that's supposed to be safe. You can install it, you can rely on it, very few bugs. And occasionally we do a bug fix release, and they tend to be very small because we feel pretty good about getting out most of the terrible bugs before the stable release. But every month there is a development release that's got the newest features that don't really work yet and have the optimizations that turn out to break stuff. So we're always breaking stuff and fixing it again, and we sort of slow down as we approach the annual release. And that's the phase we're in now, where development is slowed down a lot. We're just trying to get to the point where in May you can install it and feel good about it.
Yeah. So the stable release is the even number.
Right. It follows the Linux kernel convention.
Right. So in the development version is odd number. So right now we're at 5.21 something.
5.21.8 and 5.21.9 will come out in about 3 weeks.
Mm-hmm. So, and usually the 5.22 will be released on the 22nd of May.
Yeah, I like the it's stupid. I like to target. So what we really do is around April, late April, we start saying this is our candidate for releasing. And little bugs trickle in, little things, and we fix those one by one. And once we've gone, it's usually about 2 weeks with no problems, and we've had enough smoke reports for our statistical analysis to say we feel good about it. Then we call it a real release. And it's just so happened the last couple of years that we could keep getting on or close to the American-style date matching the version. So we had 5.18 on 5.18. We couldn't make 5.20 on 5.20. I was bummed. And this year, I'm hoping we'll see 5.22 on 5.22. But if we can do it earlier, maybe we'll do that. And if it's a little later, we're not going to release it earlier just to hit the date for sure.
Yeah, sure. It'll be interesting what happens with the Pro 5.32 then. So there's no 32.
Yeah, right. Hopefully that'll not be my problem anymore.
Yeah.
I like doing the releases, but that might be a little too many.
Okay. So the development release cycle is basically you make a snapshot of whatever in the trunk, in the master bleed. And so you explained in yesterday's slides the stability of the development releases during this year cycle. Can you explain a little bit?
Yeah. So, and actually, I'll give you a little more history again. There was a point during the early time of these monthly releases where we had a code freeze. So, like a day or two before the monthly release, we'd say, "Okay, everybody, hold off on committing." But people don't like code freezes. They want to keep pushing their work, and you don't want people to feel like they have to stop. And it's gotten to the point now where there is no code freeze for this. Whoever's doing the release will branch and do all the work and later merge it back in. And it's been really, really – it's been a big benefit to just keep things moving. With these monthly releases, they start after a code freeze because there's been this big code freeze to get the stable out the door. No one is allowed to commit new features or backwards incompatible changes for about 2 or 3 months before the release. And people start having ideas and optimizations, and they can put them in branches. But if it's in a branch, you don't feel like it's really committed and they really want to get it in. So as soon as 5.22.0 comes out, everyone is going to start committing 5.23.0's crazy changes. They're going to start committing all the stuff they've had sitting around. And this is what I was talking about yesterday, this idea that you'll see the stability of the main development branch go from very, very good to awful. It'll take about a month. The first release I tend to do hours after the stable release. So 5.22.0 and 5.23.0 will probably be the same day or the same weekend. After that, people will start committing crazy stuff. And the craziness goes on for a while. And then it starts to slow down. People see what's broken and they start fixing it. And hopefully after we hit peak crazy sometime around October or November, we see people focusing on looking at the reports from our testers. Perl development has a huge suite of automated testers who build on all kinds of platforms, all kind of options, integrate as much of CPAN as they can, and then we focus on fixing everything.
Yeah, so when you say not unstable, does that – I don't think that means the actual code will break because when you ship even the development release, it will pass all the tests in the T, right?
Yeah, we feel very strongly about having all of our tests always passing. The committers know that you are not allowed to push up code that doesn't pass its tests. And as soon as you do, what happens is an email, there's a Jenkins install, and Jenkins is constantly building Perl on a few platforms. We're constantly integrating on Windows now, which is, to me, impressive.
Yeah.
And if someone breaks the build, an email goes to the development list, and it says the build is broke. It doesn't say who broke the build, but we all know. And we get it fixed as quickly as possible. And you don't want to be the person who broke the build.
Yeah.
So at any point, we could take a snapshot. And it would be stable. It would build. The only question is, have we inadvertently broken something on CPAN? Because we can integrate all of Perl in about 5 minutes on a modern PC. Some of the platforms we build on, it takes an hour or a day. Building all of CPAN takes days.
There's interesting email that comes from the Andreas, who is the maintainer of Pose. His email subject is BBC. It's an acronym for Bleed Breaks CPAN,
yes.
I think. I think he's constantly running the bleed against a bunch of CPAN modules on his box or something. And whenever he finds out the break, he bisects all the commits and emails to profile porters list as well as maybe the author of the module in question.
Andreas Kerner cannot be thanked enough for this work. The BBC reports, Bleed Perl Breaks CPAN, people often think that he's running an entirely automated process and that he's just got a script that notices this. But what really happens is he receives huge amounts of reports from his own testing and from the testing of others. And when he starts to see a statistical variation in how things are building, he will go and read the test results personally. He will bisect carefully, and I think he does a lot of it by hand. And then he will file the report, and he will file it either with us, with the Perl 5 development, or with the module author based on who is clearly at fault, or with both.
Yeah.
And the amount of problems that it catches is amazing. And he will subsequently go in and say, last month I reported that this commit broke something. I have found 7 more things independently broken by that.
Yeah.
And we know with a high degree of certainty whether we have fixed these problems, because we'll change Perl, all the tests still pass, and now we can go test all the downstream bits that were broken. It's incredibly useful to having stable release.
Yeah, his efforts has probably been understated.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the crazy. So when you mention crazy things going to the development snapshot, what kind of crazy stuff can we expect for the next release of Perl?
The next release of Perl. It's funny because when I was building my talk and I wanted to talk about the things that were new in the 2015 version of Perl 5.22, I started off by thinking, well, there aren't as many exciting things as we had last year, and it's kind of true. Last year we added subroutine signatures, which is amazing. It's been on the to-do list for 20 years. And we added new kinds of dereferencing, really, really big stuff. But as I started going through, there were a lot of cool things this year. One of the things we talked about is the new double diamond operator for a safer iteration of file handles, which fixes a bug that probably no one knows they have, but it's a scary bug. There was a new change that came into Perl last night after my talk. There's a In Perl, we don't have a type system like many people do. We don't pick the type of data and then the operators know what to do with it. The operators apply the type to the data, which is an interesting model and it works well. But we've had a longstanding exception, which is the bitwise operators, the single ampersand, the single pipe. They look at the type of the data, but Perl's data isn't well typed. And they pick how to operate based on the type of the data, and it can lead to bizarre bugs. In Perl 5.22, there's going to be a new feature that makes those operate always on numbers. And if you want them to operate as strings, there are 3 new operators, pipe dot, ampersand dot, and caret dot. And those assume strings. So they act much more like normal Perl operators. There's a lot of other cool stuff. I think the things we're seeing this release are smaller, somewhat more esoteric, but it's a good release, and I'm certainly going to upgrade all my stuff to 5.22 as soon as possible.
You also mentioned that not just the cool new features, you're yanking out some of the legacy of Perl 5 that nobody uses today.
And it's very dangerous to talk about what features nobody uses in Perl. You'll find out people use all kinds of crazy stuff.
That's why Andreas is testing against.
And that's why Andreas tests against everything. And there's often this idea that, well, I don't use this. No one should be using this, so we'll pull it out. But Perl 5 has a strong commitment to backward compatibility, one of the strongest that I've seen in open source languages. And we really don't want to break things. We will, and there are times we will say, this is a justified breakage and we have to do it. But we also want to know what we've broken and not break it by accident. Mm. As far as removing things go, when I took over running the show, we had a lot of features that had been deprecated for years, 15, 20 years, they've been marked as deprecated, and we don't want to leave things in that position. We want to say they're coming out because we need to get rid of them. They cause problems, or they're not. And if they're coming out, they should come out. Some features have now been marked as discouraged, which just means we're going to leave it there, but please don't use it. But we're getting to the bottom of the barrel of things to remove that have been marked that way for years. So I'm looking forward to exhausting the list and saying, Perl has no more huge problems that we want to remove. The huge problems we're going to keep.
What's the actual process of removing features? Do they get marked as deprecated? And if you used it on some version of Perl, you get a runtime warnings, and then in the next version, it gets actually removed?
Yes. Yeah, so as with a lot of things like this, it wasn't always well standardized. Some things were marked deprecated in documentation. Some things had optional warnings. As of, I think, Perl 5.12, all the deprecation warnings were turned on by default. So even if you didn't turn on warnings, deprecation warnings would warn. They would say, you're using a feature that we know we want to remove from Perl, and you should probably stop. And the rule is roughly, we'll put a deprecation warning in, and it will be there for 2 years, and then we will remove the feature. And we chose 2 years so that downstream distributors, like Linux distributions especially, they don't always release in the same cycle as we do. So we want to make sure that everybody can see the warning at least once if they're regularly upgrading. Occasionally, we will pull things faster if a feature we find is if we believe a feature to be extremely obscure or believe it to be basically entirely unused, we might pull it after 1 year. And we've also said we might wait longer, although I don't think we've done that yet on anything.
Yeah. So you already mentioned it, but before 5.12, the release process was really slow and probably relying on just a few people entire voluntary time. But since Jesse took it over, it's almost like guaranteed that the new release will come out every year. So that I think the development effort, developers will be much more motivated to get that those features. And because before that, you never know when the next major release of Perl is out.
Yeah.
Even the .1, 5.10.1 took like 3 years to come out.
Yeah. And so another, so there's two things there. One was, it used to be that all the new code was added to bleed, and bleed is sort of the it's called short for bleeding edge, the dangerous branch of Perl. Things were added there, and then someone was in charge of selectively cherry picking them back into the maintenance branch, and that's a ton of work, and it was scary, it was dangerous because you didn't know how safe it was, and you had to make sure it was safe. So there's a lot of work picking the commits, resolving conflicts in the commits, and then testing them to make sure it was going to work. And the work was being done by a very small number of people. All the code then was in perforce, so there's a very small number of committers, and it was difficult. And as you say, it also meant that if you wrote a commit to Perl, you didn't know when you could ever use that. It could be applied. They would say, "That's a great feature. We've applied it." And you wouldn't know when you could use it unless you used a snapshot of Perl, which was crazy.
Yeah.
And I remember feeling really discouraged on behalf of someone else. We had a feature that was added early in 5.9, which would eventually become 5.10. When 5.10 was going to come out, I started writing a series of articles teaching people about the new features. And I found one of these features was really not going to work. It was not a good feature. And we removed it. But it had been added years before by someone who wrote the feature. They added it, and then they went away, and they weren't there to help fix or to discuss the feature. It's unlikely they ever thought it was going to come out, and we didn't ever want that to happen again. So getting these releases out once a year, I think, it's really good for morale. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And also, some of the features are added to the Perl, but not enabled by default. So these features are opt-in, and you have to explicitly declare these. I want to use this new feature. I know this might not be perfect. It might be taken out in the future if it doesn't work as expected, right?
Yeah, there's been two ways that we've done that. One is there are features that are experimental, and this is a little bit newer. And again, we had experimental features for years and years, but you couldn't always find out what was experimental. And you might be using an experimental feature and relying on it heavily. And we of the development team would say, well, it's experimental. You shouldn't rely on it. But you didn't know. And it wasn't fair because there was no way for you to know.
Yeah.
The rule now is that experimental features issue warnings. And they tell you, you're using an experimental feature. Like, you shouldn't do that. You can turn the warning off. But the way you turn it off is by putting a line in your code that says, I am using experimental whatever. So that you can't, you've forfeited your right to complain. You know, you've said, I know this is experimental. It might be yanked, changed, or anything. I'd like to get experimental features, non-experimental, as quickly as is reasonable. I'd like to know the feature works, though. And the other thing we do is some features are added, and we think they're done, but you still need to opt in because they change the way the language works. And we want to be backwards compatible as much as we can. Like I said, it's a very important value to Perl 5. So in those, you have to say, I'm turning on this feature. And usually you just say, I know that I'm using version 5.20, and that turns on all of 5.20's features.
So there's feature pragma. So I use feature say, for example.
Right.
And there's also use experimental to, for example, for signatures. I think Smart Match was one of the interesting examples, which was added to the Perl as a default standard feature, but kind of demoted to experimental.
Yeah, so there was a little bit of totally understandable unhappiness because there were a few features that did not used to issue warnings that were not really considered experimental, but they went into Perl during 5.10, during this period when development was very strange and people were not testing these features the way that we thought they might. Smart Match, you mentioned. Smart Match changed its behavior radically between version 5.10 and 5.10.1, and it was modeled after a Perl 6 feature, which subsequently also changed its behavior radically. And there are a few other features like this. Lexical topic is one of them that we, as you said, we downgraded it to experimental. We didn't want to just say rip it out, but we want to fix it. And we don't believe these are features that we endorse, that certainly I don't endorse the feature. I don't think it's going to make your program better. So we want to standardize. And if these features had been written today, they would have gone through an experimental process and they would have been fixed or removed and not released.
Okay. I think I got a couple of feedback from the listeners before the show about the subroutine signatures.
Yeah.
Because that's one of the biggest and most exciting features for 5.20, I think.
And 5.20.
Yeah, we waited for it about, I don't know, 10 years, 20 years. Is it still experimental for 22?
Yeah, so subroutine signatures were added in 5.20, and they were marked experimental. And after 5.20, Peter Martini, who is one of the developers who worked on subroutine signatures, said, "So what's the rule for something becoming not experimental?" And I said, "Well, I haven't thought that far ahead." And so we had to start describing what this policy would be. And the policy now says something like this: a feature cannot leave experimental status unless it has been unchanged for two releases. So you have to know that it's good. You have to really not want to change it. If you've changed it, now you need to live with the changed version for a while. So in 5.22, subroutine signatures are still experimental. I'm not sure whether they've changed significantly enough that they're off the table for being non-experimental in 5.24.
Okay.
We know there are some ways that we want to change them. Most importantly is the error messages they give right now are not quite as good as they could be.
Okay.
And there's some optimizations, but that's not relevant, I think, to experimental status. But yes, as for 5.22, still experimental, but I'd love to get them stable as soon as we can. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I saw Peter Martini's talk at EAPC North America last year, or maybe the year before, the process to get signature into Perl 5 core. And his how do I describe? He is so patient.
Yeah, that's what I would use also.
About the process. And I think Daisuke Maki presented the translated version of the talk in the FC Asia last year. I'll put the links to those videos in the show notes. But he basically had a greater idea of what signature should be in Perl 5, but he tried to get that into core without like putting, Perl 5 has to do this and do that and do this for signatures, and otherwise it's not perfect. But he put that feature into core in iteration so that even if the first version of signature doesn't get this right, it's better than having nothing. So that's my interpretation of the talk. And the current version of signature is still experimental in 5.20 and maybe so in 22, but it's so much better than having nothing before 20.
Absolutely, yeah. It's one of these cases where I think one of the reasons that signatures didn't go in sooner. Once you had the language for long enough without signatures, people would say there's no reason to add signatures unless they give you everything. And there's a huge discussions about what everything you need out of signatures. They need to do types. They need to do inference and coercions. And it was huge amounts of stuff. And Peter very rightly said, what I have provided leaves room for adding those features later. And I think people will find that signatures we have cover 95, 99% of your needs. And we might as well put those in. And if somebody wants to add stuff later, great. But if they don't, we have something really good now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, personally, I would like to see more in subroutine signatures, which is – so right now we haven't explained what subroutine signature is. But you can basically say sub foo and parentheses and put the variable names like dollar foo, comma,
right.
Dollar bar.
Like in every other language.
Yeah, exactly. And But I think right now it doesn't give you an API to get the list number of arguments
That's
from the
right.
subroutine difference. or you cannot type those variables. I mean, Perl 5 doesn't have strong typing, yeah. But those kinds of things, I think, are missing in terms of Peter's original idea.
Yeah, so typing of variables is a fun one, because if we add something like typing of variables, we want it to be pervasive throughout Perl, where you can type anywhere. I was really excited because Python has been doing work on gradual typing, and gradual typing is obviously the kind of typing you could add to Perl 5. If you're going to do anything, it's going to be like that. And there was going to be a talk on it yesterday, and it ended up dissolving. The talk didn't happen, and it was a real bummer. But I want to find out. I'm following that thread on the Python development. Hopefully, we can steal some ideas from them. We'll see.
Okay.
So typing is a big tough one. I'd like to see it. I don't know if it's going to happen. There is a lot of other stuff we could definitely do with signatures.
Yeah, I mean, typing isn't just useful for compile time optimization, but also useful as a documentation.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially when it comes to the subroutine signatures. So you can just see the signature by text. It has more information about its arguments and return types and stuff.
The discussions, one of the reasons that you know that Peter was so patient is that the discussions about signatures in the list were very long. Some people complained that they were sort of being talked to death, but I think that it is an important feature and it did need a lot of discussion. And one of the most interesting questions was, are subroutine signatures part of the subroutine's name or are they part of its body? And this led to a lot of really big decisions about how they would work. And I think that when you think about them as part of the name, you get all the stuff that you're talking about. You know, you want to look at the subroutine and know not just what its short name is, but what its arguments are. And if you can see these things, you can understand a lot more about how the code works without reading the body. And the less code you have to read, the better your life is.
I think it might be delaying a little bit, but Perl 5 has this one of the, I think, completely deprecated feature called shooter hash.
Yeah.
So you can declare a class, for example, point, and point has an attribute called x and y. You can declare that with the shooter hash plagma. And you can even annotate a lexical variable with my point, dollar point. That's a really nice syntax already, that Perl already has used for a completely different implementation.
Yeah, so it is a really interesting feature. You see it very rarely, and when you see it in like a Perl 5.0 introductory. You can also use this. No one uses it. A few years ago, I was on an IRC channel, and I said, "Wouldn't it be cool if you could use those for moose types?"
Yeah.
And Vincent Pitt, who has written a number of crazy, really cool CPAN modules, wrote something called Lexical :: Types. And in lexical types, you can register moose types, which are type constraints, to act like this. So you could have a point :: 3D, and you could say my point 3D dollar P, and it would be checked at all the appropriate times to make sure it was that type. I don't think that implementation is going to become a standard Perl thing, but certainly that syntax exists, and it is the kind of thing we'd want to use ubiquitously, use it everywhere. To do this pervasive type checking. And I that's an idea that excites me. I don't know when it'll happen, if it'll happen, but it would be great.
Right. Yeah. When I look at the signature and think about that shooter hash stuff, why these features can be married together to get the right signature for argument type checking and stuff. But yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the problem is the pseudo hash stuff. You get that with fields. Now, pseudo hashes are gone. There's no more pseudo hashes. Let's not even talk about those. But the fields pragma lets you associate particular hash entries with your class, and it makes a lot of assumptions about what you're even using it for. It has to be a class. It has to be a class implemented on top of hash refs. It has to be implemented with fields.pm, and it really limits what you're going to do. And that's contrary to how people want to write their Perl. And we need to. I think we need to break those rules if we want to make something like that successful, and I don't know who's going to do it.
Okay. So we are at the FOSDEM right now, as we mentioned before, and we saw the talk by Ronnie Wall this afternoon.
Yeah.
The abstract of the talk was mentioning Perl 6, but he didn't really talk about Perl a lot. What do you think about it?
I always enjoy Larry's talks. There's someone, Simon Cozens tweeted, he said, I love that Larry Wall always pretends he's going to give you a talk about Perl, but actually gives you a talk about life.
Yeah.
And Larry was talking about, so the theme of his talk was relating, he was making an analogy between The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings and Perl 5 and Perl 6. And it was interesting and I enjoyed it. And I think that a lot of people have had unfounded ideas about Perl 6 based on the fact that it's been in development a long time. And I think the most interesting thing he said was, 15 years isn't a long time to wait once you've finished waiting. Once it's released, you don't have to wait anymore. You've got it. And you can forget about the time waiting.
Yeah.
And he said he almost promised that we're going to getting a 6.0 this year. And I'm looking forward to that. I've played a little bit with it. And it's always interesting and fun to play around with Perl 6. I want to see what happens with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, he basically mentioned the beta will be available by Larry Ward's birthday in September.
Yeah.
And production release or whatever, 6.0 will be get done by Christmas.
By Christmas, as promised.
As promised. Always he mentions Christmas, but didn't mention which year.
That's
but
right.
This time he mentions this year. So any other thing we missed talking about?
No, I'm out of ideas. Of course, I haven't had much sleep here in Brussels, so.
Yeah. So are you leaving to tomorrow?
I'm leaving tomorrow. I'm leaving my hotel before dawn. So hopefully I'll get a little sleep tonight. And hopefully the East Coast will not be snowed in. Otherwise, I'll just be landing in Iceland.
Yeah, I think it's kind of unusual for you to give a talk about Perl 5 in January, February.
Because yeah, and that's one of the things I got to say. I said, usually I give the talk after it's out. So
yeah.
I know everything. Well, it's funny. I say I know everything I'm going to say is true, but we had a bug reported recently that you couldn't – this is such a bizarre feature. We added lexical subroutines. You could say my sub. Hmm. And I said the great use for this is using them with sort routines because you have to use a subroutine name. But it turned out you couldn't use them with sort routines. It just it hadn't been implemented. And there I was showing it in my examples. But usually what I say is true. This year we'll have to find out in May. But it was fun. It made for some challenges deciding what I thought was going to stick around.
Yeah. There were interesting things to come in 22. And you explain some of those in the slides, but I don't think they are useful to talk about in the audio.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the things related to like those visuals will be gone and you can change this and the backslash and
Perl's hard to talk about.
Exactly.
Got all those squiggly symbols.
Yeah, so so far we I think we're doing great. So are you going to give the updated version of the talk in the coming APSEs?
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to the updated version of the talk because for one thing, I can put in the bitwise operators, which are still secret. I can I can be a little more certain what's in and out, and I'm really hoping I can start talking about more things that we'll see in 5.24. I always like to put a little bit of that in because, of course, when I give the talk in the summer conferences, the new Perl has been out for 2 months, and we've had some things starting to land. One thing I didn't talk about yesterday was I'm expecting Perl 5.22 to be a lot faster, or at least noticeably faster for a lot of people. There are a number of really interesting optimizations, one of which really speeds up deep dereferencing. So if you have a deep reference structure, it can convert all of the dereferences into a single operator, a single opcode called multi-deref. And there are a number of other optimizations sort of sitting on the sidelines that we knew we couldn't put in yet. And I'd love to see those land in Perl 5.24. So Perl getting faster and faster as well as better and better. Love to talk about that in the summer.
Yeah. I think one of those optimizations was sponsored by Booking and as well as the Perl Foundation's grant.
Yeah, there are a few people who write fixes and patches for Perl, sponsored by the Perl Foundation, who gets donations from individuals and from companies who use Perl. Tony Cook and Dave Mitchell do a lot of this work, and Dave Mitchell has been focusing a lot of time on optimizations, partly on his work from the Perl Foundation, and he's also been doing some of this work for Booking, and the benefits have been great. And before that, there was Nicholas Clark, who has done great work from this. It's all of the money that's been going to the Perl Foundation to fund that, I think, has really paid off. It's been getting us great work and the kind of work that volunteers are less likely to do because it's hard and it's gross and it's dealing with nasty, nasty pieces of code. So yeah, Dave Mitchell has done a lot of work to optimize things, and I recently saw some of his proposals for new changes, and I think they're really exciting, and I look forward to seeing things get faster.
Yeah, nobody will complain about Perl getting faster.
That's right,
especially when they get that for free.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah. So if the listeners are interested in contributing to the development of Perl 5, what are the options to get involved?
So I always tell people they should join and read at least some of the Perl 5 Porters mailing list. I think the website, and I'll feel really embarrassed if I'm wrong, I think the website you want to go to is dev.perl.org.
I'll put the link in the show notes.
Great. Yeah. And the Perl 5 Porters mailing list is occasionally high volume. It's no Linux kernel mailing list, and it's certainly no Linux kernel mailing list for Attitude either. It's generally pretty friendly. We have rules about being friendly. You must be friendly. That's how I started working on the Perl core. I joined the list and I just read what people were talking about, and it made me a better Perl programmer, and it helped me learn how to contribute to the list. It can be a lot of mail, but you don't have to read all of it. People often ask, you know, what are some simple bugs that they can work on? And we do have a few collected tickets of bugs that need work that don't require you already know how Perl is implemented. Those bugs are often, they're tough though. If they were easy, they'd be done already. So often the best thing to do, I think, is to join the list and pay attention to what's going on and contribute that way. And when you see little problems come up, be the first person to submit the patch, and you'll see how welcome you are in the community. Absolutely.
And even if you don't know C, I mean, I myself don't know C a lot, not enough to patch Perl's source code. You can submit a documentation patch or write a unit test that addresses the problem that you have with the production code. And
I tell people I don't code in C. I do a very, very small amount of C. I have maybe two patches in the core that are basically C patches. And here I am, you know, administrating the project. You can do a lot. You can do a lot to help the project without learning C. And even if you know C, you don't have to learn the bizarre macro-laden form of C that we use to write Perl. Documentation, patches, tests, fixes to the many, many pieces of pure Perl that ship with the core. They're all great contributions.
Yeah, that's great. I'll put the links to P5P and all the, you know, documentation websites in the show notes.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, so I think that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. We greatly enjoyed the conversation. So thank you.
Thank you. It's good to be here.